In the annals of human history, the growth of nations, the rise and fall of empires appear as if dependent on the will and prowess of man. The shaping of events seems to a great degree to be determined by man's ambition, power, or caprice. But in the Word of God, the curtain is drawn aside and we behold above, behind, and through all the play and counterplay of human interests, power, and passions, the agencies of the all-merciful One silently, patiently working out the counsels of His own will. Like the stars and the vast circuit of their appointed paths, God's purposes know no haste and no delay. I've given a lot of series of studies in my life. I've never given a series of studies before on self-supporting work. I don't know why, but that just seems to be the facts of life. Do you believe that God has a plan and has always had a plan for this world and for finishing His work? You really believe that? I'd like to read from Isaiah 46, verse 9 and verse 10. Isaiah 46, 9 and 10. Remember the former things of old. I am God, and there is none else. Declaring the end from the beginning, and from ancient times the things that are not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand, and I will do all my pleasure. Let me read that again. Remember the former things of old, for I am God, and there is none else. I am God, and there is none like me. Declaring the end from the beginning, and from ancient times the things that are not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand, and I will do all my pleasure. I'd like to ask you a question. What makes any of you believe that God has a plan and that He's carrying out a plan? Somebody tell me why you believe that. Anyone else have any ideas? What's that? All right, he says so. All right, Frank. Do you think God changes His plans now and then? What? I am God, What? Change not. Therefore, you sons of Jacob are not consumed. Now, God has opened opportunities for people that they haven't accepted, but did He know they wouldn't accept it? Did He know they wouldn't do these things? And so He, from the very beginning, has been carrying forward a series of experiments with the human family. And the fact that the Bible is full of prophecies shows us that God has it all planned out many hundreds of years before Cyrus was even born. He told about Cyrus and how he was going to take the city of Babylon. God is carrying out a simple, continuous purpose, and He's going to finish it. He's going to finish it on time. He's going to finish it by the people that He knew would finish it. The only question is, just one question remains with each of us individually. Am I going to be willing to let Him carry out His plan in my life? Well, let's not get into that. That's all right. But does God have a plan He knows is going to finish His work? This is the question. And does He know He's going to have people that are going to do it? Now, are they going to be forced to do it? No, they're going to do it because they want to do it, because they have chosen to do it. You know, as I was preparing this study, I thought of a statement from page 463 of volume 5 of the Testimonies. The members of the church will be individually tested and proved. They will be placed in circumstances where they will be forced to bear witness for the truth. They'll be what?
Forced.
Many will be called to speak before councils and in courts of justice, perhaps separately and alone. The experience which would have helped them in this emergency they have neglected to obtain. and their souls are burdened with remorse for wasted opportunities and neglected privileges. What we fail to do in times of peace and prosperity, we're going to have to do under what? In fact, it says right here, this is 463, volume 5, just a paragraph before, it says, the work which the church has failed to do in a time of peace and prosperity, she will have to do in a terrible crisis under most discouraging, forbidding circumstances. As I get into the study and the history of self-supporting work, as my lifetime goes back to the time when there was no problem whatever in starting a school or a sanitarium, there were no laws regulating it. You could start a school anywhere, anytime. You didn't have to ask anybody. You could start a sanitarium, a medical work, any place, anywhere. You didn't have to ask any questions of anybody. You could get a you could get a nonprofit organization started in a matter of a few days. Anybody could go and apply for it. You got automatic federal tax exemption. Didn't even have to apply for it. This just came with it because taxes were not a problem. It's very interesting as I look back and see the things that have happened in the past. And the reason I read this statement was for myself. You know, the last 4 years, I've really been immersed in, because of circumstances, immersed in the writings of Ellen White. I've gone through all of her writings twice. I have read the Bible 7 times. I'm just finishing up my 3rd recording. And I'm just saying these things because the Lord brings circumstances to bear upon us that brings us into certain conditions. And all this material has been sort of dumped into my mind, if I can use that expression. And then in the last 2 weeks, I've been studying something about self-supporting work, and I've read a lot of material. 21 years ago now, about this time, Elder Straw and Elder Glanzer were here, and we all gave a series of studies. Elder Straw gave a study on the history of educational work. I recorded it. I still have the material. It's very interesting. The last 2 or 3 days I've been going over some of this, the first part of it, and I want to bring some of it in. But I've read recently, and I think most of you have read the book Omega. But in all the writings that I have gone through, there's one element missing. And this is what I think is real important, and I think it needs to come to the front now. The part that self-supporting work has played in the alpha of apostasy and will play in omega of apostasy is going to be a very important role. And I don't think we as Seventh-day Adventist self-supporting workers understand how vital that is, not only to our work, but to God's work as a whole. You know, we see individuals doing very simple work, but little beginnings and little things that happen have had a vital effect on the history of the world. Have you noticed that as you've studied different things? How many things had an impact far beyond their seeming importance at the time. All right, now I hardly know where to start, but let me lay down certain basic fundamental principles. We've all agreed and we all believe that God had a plan from eternity for His work. As we study the Bible, there are many people who don't understand a lot of things, and there are a lot of things I didn't understand that I'm beginning to understand now. It seems to a lot of people that God was very cruel in some of the things that He did, in just having people go out and kill thousands of people. You understand what I'm saying? We wonder why it did. But remember this, that God's problem for 6,000 years has been keeping the world going so He could carry out His experiment. The world would have been extinct of human life thousands of years ago if God hadn't put forth special effort to prolong the human race. It would have gone out of existence at the flood if God hadn't destroyed the earth and repopulated it with a few people, but not long after that. We're told in Patriarchs and Prophets that when God destroyed the people in the apostasy at Sinai, you'll find this in the chapter on Sinai, apostasy at Sinai in Patriarchs and Prophets, it says that if God hadn't immediately dealt with that sin, the world would soon have become as bad as it was at the flood. God has to deal with things very drastically at times. He dealt with Uzzah in a very special way, different. What was happening? Well, here was a situation. God had to stop it right now because remember that we have a wily foe. And he's taking advantage of every weakness of humanity. He's taking every advantage. And we also know that in the time of Christ, had Christ not come in the generation that he came in, the world would have come to an end then. Doesn't inspiration tell us that? The last generation was there. Sin had reached its height. Vice was consecrated as a part of religion. Apostasy had reached its height. He didn't destroy the world. He sent into the world a flood of healing power that would hold things together until his plan could be complete. This time, there's not going to be any cure. There's not going to be any remedy. We've come to the last end. The dregs are being drained. This time, God is going to warn the world by a people, with a people who are going to give a message. And this is the real point that I want to make here, and this is very vital. The Godhead had an eternity to plan the life of Jesus. They had an eternity. I don't know how much time there was before God started creating the universe, but there was a time in the universe when only the Godhead existed. Now, this is one of the things I like about the American Revised Version in the 16th chapter of Romans. It says that the mystery is now made manifest, which has been hid for ages past. The American Revised Version says, which the revelation of a mystery which was kept in silence through times eternal. And the prophet talks about the silence of times eternal. There was a time back there in the beginning, before God ever started creating the universe, that some basic decisions had to be made. Because they knew that sin would arise sometime. Now, I can't explain that. I'm not going to try to explain it. They knew that sin was coming, provided they made their creation with what? Power of choice. If they made beings with a power of choice, they knew that sin was coming. And so they made arrangements to take care of the emergency. Why was it necessary to make beings with a power of choice? Can some of you tell me what? I have a statement here. I'll quote it. I have it here in my Bible somewhere. Anyway, it was taken from the Watchman magazine in April 1906. And it said, why did God permit all this iniquity that man might be free? To this, there can be but one answer. It was because he knew what the rest of it is. He knew, there's another word in there. What is it? What is it?
Worthlessness.
Worthlessness, thank you. He knew the worthlessness of all forced obedience. And that the right to sin was absolutely necessary to the possibility of righteousness. In other words, all development of any being is due to their having what? Power of choice. We couldn't have happiness without the power of choice. The whole basis of development, continued development eternally, is based on the power of choice. And if we didn't have the right to do wrong, we wouldn't have the possibility of development. And so the Lord, knowing this, chose to create a universe of intelligent beings with the power of choice, knowing that someday it would be a challenge to it. Now, I don't want to get involved in that, only to this extent. The Godhead, knowing all this and making the plan, had an eternity to decide in the plan of salvation what method would be used and the form that the Son of God would take to redeem the world. And in the mind of God, the life of Christ was the perfect ultimate in the method would be necessary to save the world. You see, it was not only necessary to die for the world, but to attract the world. And the cross of Christ was essential to turn the attention of the people to the value of the plan. Christ didn't have to die on the cross. If he hadn't been strengthened by an angel, he would have died in the Garden of Gethsemane. Inspiration tells that. He fell dying to the ground, but the angel Gabriel came and strengthened him so he would be able to go through the final humiliation and die on the cross. Because it was necessary for this to attract people to a desire for salvation. And it's the cross that attracts. Now, what I'm trying to say is this, that the Godhead had a plan of a life that would be the most effectual in saving humanity. If there had been any other way to do it, they would have done it. And so when you study the life of Jesus, you're studying the ultimate in a life that was set up that had no interest in earthly authority or earthly power, absolutely ignored all of the principles that the world believes in making, doing everything you can to promote yourself. Did Jesus ever do anything to promote himself? You see, this was the character of God demonstrated in a human being in the midst of a world that was going absolutely the opposite direction. Now, the next is that in order to finish God's work on earth, the character of Christ must be duplicated. Do you all agree as to that? When the character of Christ is perfectly reproduced in his people, then he will what? Come to claim them as his own. And there's a reason, folks, why the 144,000 follow the Lamb whithersoever he goeth. Because they are the people who have learned on this earth through the power of a combination of humanity and divinity to reproduce the life of Christ. Is this clear in your mind? This is what God is trying to do. This is why it's taken so long. And this is why when he gets the people ready, he's going to finish the work very rapidly. How long did it take Jesus to finish his ministry? 3.5 years. I'm very sure that it won't take God's people any longer than that to evangelize the world when Jesus' character is reproduced. And first of all, 3.5 years was as long as the world could stand Jesus. Is that right? They couldn't stand him but 3.5 years. Caiaphas said, and even the people who were the ones who had the gospel, the ones who had the oracles, who were the expositors of God's law, they couldn't stand Jesus but 3.5 years. And Caiaphas got up and said, it's necessary to get rid of this man to save the nation. Well, he was dealing with a principle he didn't understand. It was necessary for Jesus to die to save the nation, but they did it from malice and jealousy, from a totally wrong spirit. Now, the thing that let's realize that in all of our studies, we are looking to some method, some plan, or a combination of things that will bring into fruition God's purpose, and that is that the life of Jesus must be reproduced once more in order to finish His work. Now, in order to do the finishing of God's work, God had to set up a new organization in the earth. And in 1844, we find the message of Revelation 14 coming to fruition. This was the everlasting gospel. It was the last phase of the everlasting gospel. The everlasting gospel had been, if it's the everlasting gospel, had it been preached before, some part of it? Was there an everlasting gospel in the time of Noah? What was it? Come in the ark. Real simple, wasn't it? But what did it take to go in the ark? It took all you had, and it took more than you had. It took all that the Lord could give you too. To go into that ark with all the people around watching took something that not many people had. Because they had to go against all of the great scientific knowledge and education of their day, because here was a wild fanatic who had an idea it was going to rain when it had never rained and couldn't rain. When we come to Jesus' time, the everlasting gospel, now I could go into other phases, but when you come to the time of Jesus, the everlasting gospel was what? The kingdom of heaven is at hand. Jesus came to set up a kingdom. That was the gospel of that day. And it was an acceptance of a man who came from God. And the Jews stumbled all during the life of Jesus over the fact that Jesus was a man and couldn't be what? He couldn't be God. We come to the time of the Reformation, and they had the everlasting gospel. What was the phase of it in the time of Luther and all of these men? The just shall live by faith. And when we come to the last gospel, we find the culmination of the whole thing. It's the message coming into the ark. Is there an ark today? Yes. And is it a message of the kingdom of heaven is at hand? Yes. Is it a message of righteousness by faith? But it goes farther than that. It's a message of righteousness by faith that contemplates the uniting of divinity with humanity in order that their power might be manifest that will enable the life of Christ to be reproduced. You see, the thing that people stumbled over in Jesus' day was the fact that He was the Son of God. And folks, the thing that people are stumbling over today, and the great deception is going to be that human beings can become members of the family of God. And by the power that Jesus gave them, can be partakers of the divine nature. They're putting it forward to a time when it's too late to make any changes. What would be more tragedy? What would be a greater tragedy than to be waiting for a train that was going to leave at 3 o'clock and you thought it was going to leave at 4? See, we bought some property in New York by the providence of God because a real estate developer thought that the auction was going to be 11 instead of 10. You see, the whole problem has been too little and too late. And not by faith believing the things that were coming. You see, it would have been no problem at all for Noah to fill the ark. God could have filled that ark, they'd have been crawling all over it if he just had a little shower before Noah went in. You think it had been any trouble getting people into the ark? The problem wasn't getting people into the ark. The problem was what? Getting people to believe that God, what God said was true. All right, now we come to the to the last phase of the gospel, the everlasting gospel, which is the hour of God's judgment is come. You see, it wasn't until we came to the sanctuary and we see the heavenly sanctuary and Jesus work in the sanctuary do we see the way, the power, the method that God is going to use to get people ready to finish His work. And so the thing the devil is going to hit at more than anything else is to strike at the preparation to give God's last message, you see. If he can stop that, he's going to stop it. He's going to stop most people, but he's not going to stop some people. I'm thankful for that, aren't you? So when we come to 1844, we find that a large group of people, during the summer of 1844, the history says that 50,000 people came out from the churches and joined the Advent movement. But Jesus didn't come in 1844. And the Lord had permitted definite time to be preached for the purpose of bringing people to decision. And when it was all over, and Jesus hadn't come, how many were left? You could count them on your fingers almost, couldn't you? James, White, Ellen Harmon, who soon became Mrs. E.G. White, Hiram Edson, Joseph Bates, Farnsworth, Hiram Edson, yes. Even William Miller himself wasn't able to make the transition. Thank the Lord he could save him, but we have a little group of people, and as you go back and read history, as you read the history, here was a little group of people that would take the gospel to the world. And they had great resources. Captain Bates had 12 cents left. And James White had 9 cents. And had to decide whether or not he was going to buy something to eat or some cloth to cover his naked baby. I mean, his wife had to. These people started out to evangelize the world. We think we have a hard time today. We don't know what faith is, do we? Here was this group of people. And folks, look. Here's a very interesting thing, and let's carry this through. There's some cement here that has never been known in the history of the world, and this is one thing we want to study about very definitely. You see, all down the history of the world, when we came to a great apostasy, the Lord had to move in, or we came to a great revival, and then soon, after not too long a time, the devil got into the organization and demoralized it. And what did the Lord do? He had to move over and start. The Lord had to move the candlestick. Is that right? But the strange thing is that when we get to the seventh, that's it, and he isn't going to move the candlestick anymore. So there's going to have to be some special things regarding the seven. See, in the Bible prophecy, all the sevens come into focus at the same time. They all end at the same time. And so we find these people starting out, and folks, they were all self-supporting workers. There was no organization. There was no educational system. There was no great plans for world evangelism. They just started out with what they had and began to work. And folks, the cement that held it together was that the Lord set in this church the gift of prophecy. You see, since apostolic times, we have no record of any prophet who God had set apart for a specific work. In the apostolic church, there were many prophets. But when we come down through all these other organizations, we don't, until we come to the seventh church, do we find the distinct characteristics of that church are that they keep the commandments of God and have what? Have the testimony of Jesus Christ. And friends, I believe it's the cement of the gift of prophecy, the testimony of Jesus in the Laodicean church is going to be what's going to take it through. And there's another thing that I want to bring here that I think is real important. In all the history of God's church through the ages, He did something under the church, the Laodicean church, that had never happened before. If you go back and study the history of Israel, you'll study the history of the time when they had kings. I don't have my books here. I could read it to you. It says that when Israel chose to have a king, they were not given the privilege of choosing their own king. Israel, through the ages, never were commissioned or had the privilege of choosing their leaders. God chose their leaders. And God has always chosen leaders. But you know, when we come to the Laodicean church, and they started out in 1844, and they had no organization, they had no money, they had nothing. But as they went out and began to work, the Lord began to add to them, and people began to come into the church, and they had no schools. They had no long-range plans. Why? Because they knew that the Lord was coming very soon. But somehow, the devil began to get into the group and began to neutralize the things. And so the Lord, of course, knowing that time was going to be prolonged, had to do something or had planned to do something to extend the organization. So what did he do? Well, he gave his messenger, Ellen White, instruction that the church should organize. That they should set up an organization. They hadn't any plans for organization. Nobody had any idea of organization. But the Lord knew that there was going to be a waiting time and that the organization was going to be necessary to hold the church together. Without that, there would be no possibility of this church continuing. And as you go back and study the history of the denomination, folks, for over 100 years, it's been the organization that's held us together. Let's recognize that. And in 1861, the instruction came, and the first organization was the organization of the Michigan Conference. 1863, the message came for a general organization, and so the General Conference was organized, and everything was set up so that they would have the legal authority to own property, to have their organization. They could ordain their ministers, and then shortly after that, the Lord gave them instruction that they should start a school. I was very interested in the chronology of this. Now, I've gone over several of these things, and it's very interesting what began to happen. In 1861, of course, the Michigan Conference was organized. In 1863, the instruction began to come out regarding the importance of having an educational program. And I'd like to give you folks a reference to read. We should all read it because this is real important, because this is the basis on which and out of which self-supporting work came. Now, I haven't even gotten to self-supporting work except in the early days that all of the work was self-supporting. Remember, there was nothing but self-supporting work until 1861. When the organization came, everybody was on his own. There was no money, you know, there was no way. There was some tithe coming in, but it wasn't on a very organized basis. And then there came out the things that would go with the organization. Now, this is real important. Do you know what the first instruction was that came out to enable us to know that we should have what should go into the organization in order that the work had carried on? The Lord gave instruction to Ellen White that there should be schools established. And right closely in connection with that, there was something that always goes with education, and what is that? that there should be a reform in diet. A reform in diet. And in the education that was told to have, I hope all of you, here's a reference. This is in several places in the Spirit of Prophecy, but the first came in volume 3, page 131. I wish you'd all read this chapter, Proper Education. It's real important that we understand, because here was a new principle of education. How it should be carried out. But you know what the problem was? There was nobody in the world who knew how to carry out education. We had come through the Dark Ages, and the education that were now in existence was what came out of the old papal system. We had come out, we had accepted the Sabbath, we had accepted the third angel's message, but we were still involved with the old education. And so when the instruction came, we should set up a school. Well, now, the first school that was set up in Battle Creek was not a denominational school. It was a school set up by Professor Bell. And this was in 1872. It was a private school. And he specialized in teaching English. And the students began to go there and get an understanding of this. But the instruction was that we should start a school. And the instruction on education had come at the beginning, before this came. The Lord had brought to Sister White what should happen in education. And education was three definite parts that were all to be important. Do you know what the first one was? That in the school, the first and foremost part of education should be useful work. Useful work. We'd come to a time when work was, everybody was trying to learn to get to live without working, you know. Work was not popular. People wanted to get a training so they'd get away from work. And she outlined very definitely that the most essential part of education is useful work. And it was in this method of education that we were to get the character development and the physical strength that will enable us to get the second part of education, which was the scholastic. And this was to be secondary to the education that was to come through work. And the third was that there was to be a period set aside for devotion, spiritual growth and spiritual activity. Well, in 1872, the Battle Creek College was established, but they didn't know who to get. They didn't know who to put in charge of the school. And there was a young man there who had just graduated from the university. He just graduated from the university, and so his name was Sidney Brownsberger. He didn't know anything much about the instruction, evidently, that the Lord had given, but he was the only one who had the recognition. And to see, the thing that man never is able to figure out, how that man can never do something that he's never done. This is the problem of the human race, that man can't do something he's never done or ever been trained to do. But when God starts out a movement, he always takes somebody that has never done what he's told him to do, and he teaches them how to do it. He has a real problem in taking people who already are trained how to do something and get them to do the way he wants to do it. Could you give any examples of this? Right? What about Moses? Did Moses know how he was to deliver Israel? He didn't? Didn't he think he knew? Well, sure, he went. That's why he killed the Egyptian. He was starting off on the deliverance of Israel. But what was the problem? He started off all wrong. So what did the Lord have to do? Had to, and let him get education in Midian for 40 years. When the Lord started this church, was it people who had had long years of experience in theology, long experience in education? Who did he take? He took people who had no experience at all. There's a very interesting biography of James White. I let it go down to the printing shop to get the first pages printed. Somewhere I recorded it several years ago. It's out of print now. I'm going to try to get hold of it. James White, total education was 21 weeks. These men were not educated people. But when they started school, of course, they had to have somebody that had what? Had an education. So from the very start, our educational program was in trouble. In 1872, the Battle Creek College was set up, and Sidney Brownsberger was the president. Bell was in charge of the English department, and Uriah Smith was head of the Bible department. And it was very interesting, as Elder Straw was discussing it. I was just listening to it this morning. He and Elder Glanzer said, as they studied it, they found that two or three times a week he gave a lecture on the Bible, and that was the Bible department. But Sidney Brownsberger, who was educated in the school, started out with a regular scholastic program, and Bell wanted to spend part of the time, part of the day, in work, the teachers working with the pupils, because that was where the real education was. And they got into a real wrangle. And after about 2 years, why, Sidney Brownsberger resigned, and there was a very interesting, Uriah Smith joined with Professor Brownsberger in the fact that they shouldn't make the students work, that they should give them an education. And Sister White wrote the testimony to Uriah Smith, says, "My dear esteemed brother, I'm very sad to find you on the wrong side of the controversy." And this, she received a letter. Well, our time is gone. We've gone a little bit over. I'm going to leave this right here. As I've studied into self-supporting work, I find that it was out of the confusion and the differences of opinion and the difficulties of our educational work that the Lord brought in self-supporting work. As we study it, it's going to be very interesting to see how this develops.